Blog Talk Radio.
I shall.
Thanks. Once again, it is time for the worst 90 minutes in soccer podcasting. That's right. It is the Two Guys Soccer Show. And tonight, Manchester City is back in the Champions League. But apparently, Chelsea, Leicester, and Man United aren't excited to join them. There was a North London derby, which crowned a North London champ. That and $1.50 gets you the title of North London champ. Omar Gonzalez posted a picture of a $65 ham and cheese sandwich from Orlando, which leads me to believe that I'm in the wrong line of business. I should be doing food service someplace. And the Washington Redskins, after 87 years, decide to retire their name. Unfortunately, they can't come up with another one because there is a real estate agent in Virginia who has trademarked them all. I am joined as always, I'm Mike, and I'm joined, as always, by my partner in crime, Mr. Stead. How you doing this evening?
Wow. I can say I've had better days, but I'm here, joined by my partner in crime, currently not Baby Yoda. So hopefully she'll go to sleep and, you know, give me a chance to get some rest. But overall, you know, still kicking, living the dream.
Mm-hmm. She's still upset at Sunday's result?
My son decided to have his birthday party during the game, so I'm not sure she was even aware it was going on. Only I was, but yeah. But you know what? Even if she saw it, she's going to say, I can't say I'm surprised.
And from across the pond, one of our favorite correspondents. Good morning, London Sean. How goes it this morning?
It goes very well. Thank you very much for inviting me back. Lovely to hear your voices again. And yeah, all is good. All is good in not so sunny England.
Not so, you know what? I was feeling for you this week. It had to be a rough one for you. The North London Derby. It had to be a bad Sunday. Weather's going down the toilet.
England lost.
Tossed one away against the West Indies.
Yeah.
And yeah, Arsenal lose. And Arsenal loses just about the same time that the cricket match wraps up.
Mm-hmm. There's an owner's story. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for coming out of from behind the dark cloud and joining us as once again. So, we've got a packed show tonight. We're going to be joined in a little bit by a very, very, very good friend of mine who goes back a long time with me. Charlie Flo is going to join us from Philadelphia. He's he is the coach of the Philadelphia Lone Star Women's the FC Women in the WPSL. He's the host of the World Sports Show out of Philly, and he's a youth soccer coach for United Philly Soccer. He's going to come on in a little bit and talk about the MLS's back tournament. And then Carlos is going to join us at about 9 o'clock and talk about the North London Derby and recap that. I don't even know. Do we call it thrilling, disappointing? Depends on who the takers are. To me, it was a typical Jose game. in the North London Derby, we saw Tottenham on Sunday win, run out 2-1 winners. But before we get there, Mr. Charlie.
How are you?
I'm doing fine. That was not Baby Yoda, the show's mascot. Charlie and I go back a long time. He's out of Philly. You've been covering the Philadelphia Union since pretty much there was a Philadelphia Union, right?
Yeah, I mean, covered him before they even had an official name. That's how long it's been.
So when the MLS back tournament came on and then they played their first game, and I don't know if you, Sean, and you, Stead, caught it, but Union came out before the match. They all wore Black Lives Matter T-shirts, and then they took off the T-shirts, and each one of them had the name of an African-American or minority who was a victim of police violence. Some that you know of, like Andre Blake, wore George Floyd's name. I saw a Tamir Rice in there. Some that were lesser known, and Jim Curtin explained it as, you know, they wanted to take this opportunity to make a statement, and that the players were wearing names that either they knew of, or in the case of some of the non-African-American players, names of people who they had learned about. And then below the name, they had the slogan, "One name is one too many." And I thought it was a really powerful statement. I wanted to get your take on that, Charlie.
No, it's powerful. I think it really hits home when you see these players that you and I and everybody looked up to wearing somebody's name on the back of their, you know, jersey kit that, you know, perished, you know, at the hands, you know, the police of, you know, gun violence and police violence brutality. And it hits home because it's surreal seeing an athlete wear that jersey. And I'm sure it gets me emotional just because it brings them back to life for that few moments that somebody's playing in their honor.
And I thought it was a great message. I mean, I don't want to sit here and say, like, we're against the police, but this is something that we've been drawing attention to. And I like the idea of them saying, you know, one name is one too many. Let's kind of cut this out. I'm almost tempted to go with I forgot his name. His line. Can't we all just get along? Rodney King, can't we all just get along? It was a really powerful statement. And they ran out 1-0 victors to open up the MLS tournament Group A play. Did you get a chance to watch the game?
Yeah, watched it from start to beginning. You know, I'm a father now of a young daughter, so a 9 o'clock in the morning game. It reminds me and you hanging out watching EPL games at like 7 in the morning down at an Irish pub, so... Yeah, I'm all for these 9 a.m. games. I dig it.
I was loving it. The start times are a little awkward for this tournament. We've got 9 a.m. games, and then we've got 9 p.m. games. And tomorrow they play at 10:30 at night. Now, in MLS's great wisdom, the game will not be televised because there is a game starting at 9. So the 10:30 game will be played on a field next to the one that's played at 9. They said they're doing it because, producer Paul will tell you, it is hot down in Florida. And they want to keep them out of the temperature as much as possible. But what did you think about the late start time for the difference in between the early start time and the late start time for these games? How do you think that affects the players?
That's tough. I mean, you have that window of recovery. And honestly, from a coaching point of view and a player point of view, it's a lot easier to play late. You know, you just kind of let yourself sleep in. You maybe get that midday nap. I think the hardest, honestly, the 9 a.m. games, because you think about a 9 a.m. game, that's when they're kicking off. And, like, what time are they actually leaving the hotel? These are the things where you got guys probably waking up at 5:30 in the morning because they want to get a full breakfast in their body and have it fully digested, not before kickoff, but actually before they warm up. So you're looking, a lot of these teams are out there stretching probably an hour before the match, and they're in the locker room an hour and a half, 2 hours before going over technical stuff. So, yeah, I can't imagine. I've had to coach games that early before, you know, and it's not fun, you know. But 10:30 at night, kind of cool, you know. I mean, it's kind of funky when you get done. It's practically 1 in the morning when you're done.
So you'd rather go with the 10:30 than the 9 a.m.?
Oh, yeah, any day of the week, man.
So what did you see from the Philadelphia Union in their first game?
Yeah, I mean, I saw a team that has good defense, good goalkeeping. You know, Andre Blake kept them in the game several times. And, you know, they're playing a New York team that was missing a few pieces, a game that New York could have won, dominated a lot of part, but I think the Union did great on their counterattacks. And I think the cool part about this Union team, if it's the good Union team that we saw last year, they're going to capitalize on New York's mistakes, and they're going to capitalize on the few opportunities they have. You know, the big thing in soccer world is a lot of people are obsessed with possession, and I think Barcelona, you know, take the possessions that you have that are few and far between and capitalize on them, and they did such a great job of just weathering the storm of the first and second half and then capitalizing late.
Do you make the Philadelphia Union one of the favorites to win this tournament?
I think that it's such a hard tournament to predict, you know, that this is probably the wackiest prediction things. And when it comes to Vegas, you can't just look at the X's and O's and look at the team on paper, that we have so many factors of, all right, how well are the players being taken care of within their bubble and stuff like that. So I really would probably say maybe a 1-4 chance the Union will come out on top of this, because it just seems that their camaraderie, their team chemistry, how they're taking care of their players, and we're not hearing any negative stories coming out of their camp, that, yeah, that reflects so highly on their performance on the field, of how they're behaving and their happiness off the field, I could say, because they are in this, like, luxury prison, as Ala Bedoya said. It's a luxury prison they're in, and happiness is very key on how these players perform.
Did you see Omar Gonzalez's sandwich on Twitter?
I did, and tough line, because this is the times where all the PR staff have really got to be on these players, saying the amount of moving parts to make this work, make anybody's head spin, like the amount of money these leagues are putting in to secure your safety and all that, that let's put things into perspective. We got people in America lining up to get food and not exactly in the best situation. So these players got to be very careful, and it's a delicate, you know, line to cross when you're complaining about food, when we got so many Americans that are going to get boxed meals here in Philadelphia.
Outside of the Union, who do you is there anybody in the tournament that you think is going to be a tough out? Anybody who you would line up as a favorite?
I mean, the New York teams are always going to be tough with Philadelphia. They're the ones that are always through the regular season right, and the new LAFC team is always going to be this, you know, not always, they've only been around a couple of years, but the LA teams are always, you know, good playoff type. It's such a weird format, excuse me, that I wouldn't take it past being an LAFC. I mean, a lot of teams are missing parts, so I think it's still very early in a tournament, you know, that we have such a small sample size of teams right now that it's really, I think it's the most wide open MLS tournament they've ever had in their existence.
Yeah, right now LAFC is trailing Houston 2-1. DC United had a little bit of trouble first getting in, second getting on the field, and then a little bit of trouble when they got on the field. They went down to 10 men, but somehow managed to pull out a late draw. I'm going to give you a chance to catch your breath. Stead, what did you think of that?
Yeah, that was a bit of a coup there. You know, United's been United. You know, they've been very up and down, and probably much more so down recently, besides the quick jolt of energy they had from Wayne Rooney. So I think, as you know, with the trouble they had just kind of just getting on the field, take this draw and run. I mean, that's probably the best you're going to hope for, going down 2-0 and getting a card. So, they showed some real spirit. They showed some real fight, which is always good. But I would say that was more of a Toronto loss than DC United got back in that game. So, but hey, take it and run, and know that you kind of got over one there.
So back to you, Charlie. There hasn't been an awful lot of scoring. Only, I think, 3 or 4 games thus far, including tonight, have featured multiple goals. Is the lack of scoring down to the break and the team still finding their way kind of through the preseason, because they only had 2 weeks before the season stopped?
Yeah, I mean, it's weird because you had the first few weeks, you had a full training camp, you hit the reset button. So, I mean, the biggest thing that a lot of coaches approach a game is on a conservative thing is don't give up goals. So you're going to play like a defensive mindset, you know, and you, a lot of these teams out there play high-tempo football. You're trying to get back to high-tempo football, but you have this quick, you know, tournament where you don't want to, I say, like, overuse your players. Like, load management is very important. So if you're a high-tempo team that's looking to play box-to-box soccer, this isn't for you because, A, you got the heat to deal with. These players are supposed to be in keeping themselves in shape on their own, which I don't doubt that they did. But there's something about actually playing soccer and then just being like a gym rat, you know. It's just that I think it's a lot of these guys are going to slowly get their legs under them, and you have all these different sub-rules. So I can see why a lot of these coaches come in with more of a conservative, hey, let's just focus on not giving up goals. And, you know, we have to weather it. It's like, it's more of a, not a sprint, but a marathon, because you're so like bang, bang, bang with these games and your recovery time. And point early about the wacky start and finish times. I mean, it's so hard to manage all the factors. So I think a lot of coaches are coming up with the conservative, hey, let's one game at a time. Let's try to get a point out of this. I mean, go for the draw, you know?
So what have you thought about the overall production as it's been split in between ESPN and FS1 thus far? How they've produced the games, how they've covered it. What are your thoughts on the general way they've presented these games to us?
I mean, I guess that I'm not exactly the same as, like, the viewer audiences, people that are watching for the entertainment. I kind of watch it to be entertained, but I'm going to watch it kind of a coaching point of view. That I've enjoyed these fanless games to hear the pop, hear the coaches. So I think my biggest complaint, I think, is the fake crowd noise. I know that the TV people like that. They want to make it sound like people are there, but everybody in the world knows soccer is being played behind closed doors. So we have a really unique opportunity to see some of the highest skilled professional athletes in the world play a game where we can hear them talk. We can hear the coaches, and it's a learning point. But why a lot of these production staff out there think we need fake crowd noise, and I mean, we're missing an opportunity that we may never have again in our lifetime. You know, if this all passes over and we're back to normal, we'll have packed stadiums, so we will hear the crowd. So that part of the production, it's going on every league in the world where they're pumping in fake crowd noise. And I think they're missing the big picture that we already know the stadium's empty. So let us hear what the players say.
I think that one of the big problems with that was what we saw ESPN in the first game versus with Inter Miami and Orlando City FC, is that they have so many mics on the field that every once in a while, it picks up something it's not supposed to. And there are quite a few times that the announcers, the commentators, had to cover up what was said and apologize for it. I think they're doing it as much to cover themselves from FCC violations as anything, because you certainly get what you do hear what the players are saying when you don't get any crowd noise. And occasionally, well, they use language that's not necessarily appropriate for broadcast TV.
True.
And but it's completely understandable. I mean, if I scored a late winner, I'd probably have a few choice words too. So, my last question about the tournament is, for people who don't watch a lot of MLS, give us a reason to watch MLS. I know you have watched a lot of Premier League games with me, and this ain't the Premier League, but why should we be watching MLS?
I think the big thing is you want to see your domestic league do well. And you and I, we've known each other before there was even a Philadelphia Union, for example, team that came out in 2010. So we were friends before that. So we were only used to what we saw on TV. And now that we're seeing the MLS in several large and small markets, I think it's very key that you support your domestic product to see it grow. You know, that we have this potential in our country to support multiple sports and support them. I mean, like you're down in D.C., I'm here in Philly, that we're both in cities that have multiple teams, and we support all of our teams almost equally. So it's one of those things where, you know, we keep supporting it and keep, you know, supporting it, watching it, going to the games, then eventually the product is going to get better. The more revenue, the more sponsorship. So, yeah, we will eventually be able to compete with these European leagues. That every European player that I've ever met and became friends with, they all really enjoy playing here. They like this country. They like the facilities. So I think it's just a matter of, you know, being patient and realizing this league hasn't been around forever, and it's going to become that. If we want to have a really good men's national team, we have to invest in our domestic product. We want to keep our players playing in the same league against each other and on the same team instead of being spread out over the globe.
So give me a person, a player, a team, a coach that you would want viewers to pay attention to over the course of the next month or so as this tournament is going on.
You know, I definitely think the Philadelphia Union, because they did so well last year. Made it to playoffs, you know, that beat New York Red Bulls in the first round of playoffs, you know, fell short, you know, to Atlanta on the road in the playoffs. So, I mean, you're talking a tight game in Atlanta. So we're looking at an Atlanta team that has come out as a new team, only a couple years old, won a championship, won the MLS Cup, and the Union were able to go toe-to-toe with them. You're talking a few parts a little different and a few games and a few bounces. You could argue that the Philadelphia Union could be, you know, MLS champ. So I love what they're doing. I love what Ernst Tanner's doing with this team as a sporting director. I had some great conversation with him just about his vision of the future of the club and just a lot of his mindsets. A lot of these things that a lot of us casual fans and coaches think of, just, you know, coming down to performance, all these European mindset things that are why these clubs run so well, because they're thinking of coming down to what every player eats, the hours they sleep, how they're recovering, and these things weren't there when the Union started, but they are now, and it's just it's great to see them becoming that standard of a European type of club.
So, buddy, you are involved in soccer just about every level. So as I get you out of here, why don't you give us a little overview about what you do back up there in Philadelphia?
Yeah, so it's kind of a around-the-clock type of thing. 12 months out of the year, I'm pretty much involved with the game. I've got four youth clubs ranging from like all the way down from U12 girls all the way up to U17 girls. And then I have the Philadelphia Lone Star team, which is a team in the WPSL, which is one level below the NWSL, which is the highest level league in the world. So we get some really talented players. I've been able to work with my team last year. We had about six internationals on our team that had played in World Cups. So, you know, and then down to the lowest where I do a lot of development with little kids programs. So it's fun to just be involved in this game 12 months out of the year, and just very strange that I haven't been able to do my job, but I've been in contact with all my players on every team that I coach through various online meetings and, you know, emails and chat room type things. And I've really learned about getting into like online training with my players. So it's one of those things that, you know, as coaches, we have to always learn to, I guess, evolve and realize that you're always going to have an obstacle, you know, in your way, and things aren't always going to go perfect. So you just got to make the best of the tools you have. Keep your kids active. But, no, it's great, and this is so cool that you're doing this show, Mike. I really, really appreciate you having me on, appreciate your time, and appreciate just a fellow friend for the love of the game. You know, it's good to have grown with you, that a lot of us have different teams that we cheer for, but at the end of the day, we just love the beautiful game.
Thanks a lot, Charlie. We'll have you back on as the tournament goes on. So thanks for joining us.
Sure, sounds good, Mike.
Charlie Flo coming to us from the city of brotherly love.
Thanks, Mike.
So,
see you soon.
Take care, Charlie. So, Stead, how much of this tournament have you watched?
I've watched about 35 minutes of this tournament. It's about all I've seen. It kind of snuck up on me because, you know, we had they kind of had some start and stops, and I know that there was a lot more cases in with these players than I'm sure they were expecting. So I haven't really been catching much of it, but I think it's coming in just at the right time as Premier League's wrapping up. So to go to piggyback on what our guest just said, it is a good idea, especially for us over here in the United States, to go ahead and start watching the product.
Yeah, I mean, it's the 25th anniversary of MLS.
Yeah, which is amazing, by the way. I mean, I think that's absolutely amazing.
It is absolutely amazing. It is, in the modern era, if you will, the most successful domestic league that we've had. And it's one that doesn't look like it's going anywhere as they seek to expand to from 26 to 30 teams. And they continue to grow. The attendance numbers were up. We talked about what Atlanta did, putting close to like 55,000 people last year, making them one of the highest drawing teams in the world. It is one of the, I think it's in the top 20 in average attendance. And so it is a good lead to follow. You have to know what you're watching. And
yep.
We can argue whether what level it's on, whether it's championship level, whether it's first division or what is it, League One level, level, whether it's on par with, say, the Dutch League.
But
it's a good tournament, and we're going to keep following it.
So absolutely. I
want to thank again, Charlie, for joining us and giving us a little bit of his time this evening to talk about the Philadelphia Union. He literally has been covering them since before there was a team.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And yeah, we go back quite a ways. So, moving across the pond, we're going to be joined shortly by Mr. Carlos Rosali, who I'm sure is going to have a fair few things to say to you, gents. But before he gets on, I want to give you a chance to voice your opinions on what happened. So, Sean.
Yes.
You have been an Arsenal fan
since 1878.
Yes, I was not going to go there, but I'm going to let you do it.
Yeah, no, I've been an Arsenal fan for a very long time.
And I know that you have seen a fair few of these go the way that you want them to, and a fair few that haven't. And I'm not going to ask you where this one ranks because, in the grand scheme of things, it's kind of arbitrary. But what were your thoughts on this Sunday's North London derby?
What were my thoughts? So the first thing I say is it was the first game that I actually went back to watch a game in a pub, because our pubs have now reopened and they have permission to show sport. So I thought I'd obviously go out and ensure that the local pubs in town survive through this COVID-19 period. So it was great. It was lovely to be in an area where I could both smoke and watch football on about 8 large screens. I'd say there was about 30 odd people that had ventured to come out to watch the game. And I have to say that before the game kicked off, I held our chances of winning quite highly. As we all know, it's not exactly how the script unrolled, so to speak. I thought it was a spectacle for the neutral viewer. Hopefully, what came across was the sort of the passion and the fact that the players seemed to be putting a little bit more energy into the game, so much so that our defenders actually forgot how to pass the ball to themselves. Which obviously happened in about the 19th minute. A very disappointing result. And I think from an Arsenal perspective, we didn't learn anything particularly new. What we had forgotten was how terrible our defence is. They'd managed to sort of cover that up in the previous games with some very good victories against Wolves and Sheffield United. But the last week has been somewhat disappointing, having let 2 games now on the trot where we've gone 1-0 ahead and drawn one and obviously lost the game on Sunday. I think what hurts for me is the fact that, unfortunately, about 3 of my best friends are all Tottenham fans, and as you can imagine, the texts on my phone have not stopped since Sunday evening, as they say. Mm-hmm. So from a personal perspective, I think what was the most disappointing fact about the game is that we dominated for so long, the fact that we went ahead and effectively gave away two very cheap goals. The first one was absolutely ridiculous. And I must give Mr. Mourinho a little bit of credit. He's not my favourite person in the world, and sort of never has been, really, after his comments about Arsene Wenger all those years ago, his voyeur comments. But I'll give him credit in that he had a particular game plan. He saw our weaknesses and made the most of what I see as a very average Tottenham side, but was very good at stopping us from dictating the play. And when Spurs were attacking, they took big advantage of the spaces that we were leaving at the back. So I hope that was comprehensible. It's quite difficult for me to talk about such a painful event. But there we are. There's my summation.
So, Stead, I know you didn't necessarily get a chance to watch it. I'm sure that you've seen highlights, lowlights, read the match reports and everything. What did you make of Arsenal and their
performance? I did actually record the game and was able to kind of like watch bits and pieces of it when I had time. And, you know, I can't say anything differently than what London Sean has shared. In the end, yes, you are right. It's two mid-table teams battling out to see who can get the final seventh spot for Europa League. And, you know, and seeing how we have an informed Sheffield team now who's won three in a row, looks like that's going to be even more difficult, even with Wolves taking some L's like they have been lately. So it was quite disappointing also because, you know, it is a derby game. And you don't want to lose those games. You don't want to get swept and lose, you know, two games to or you know, have the whole. I didn't realize there was a champion of North London until a couple of days ago. That was of course disappointing, of course. But you know, in the end, you know, we didn't learn anything. It's still more very much of the same. Arsenal's glaring holes in defense, as well as their inability to defend set pieces, which has been a glaring hole in their game for a number of years now, came back to bite them. And, you know, it doesn't – and also, you know, I'm not going to give their attack a pass. Yeah, they had a beautiful goal early in the game. They had their opportunities that they were unable to capitalize on. And while they did dominate for several stretches of the game, they did not really put enough pressure on – the goal, because with the way they were playing as far as their attack and driving forward was concerned, it looked like they could have scored two or three goals that game. So that being said, you know, yes, Jose Mourinho had a good game plan against them. He knew that Arsenal's defense was going to make mistakes and just kind of coached his team to capitalize on those mistakes in order to win the game, and they were able to do that. You know, and also Arsenal's defenders are just not good enough. I mean, they're just not good enough to compete. They're just not. And if they're going to be a side that wants to compete for European places, they have to have better defenders. And as long as they have the defenders that they have, this is just going to be the script that's going to be written. And Arteta knows what the problem is, and he can do what he can to fix it. But when your players just aren't good enough, and also they really lack a lot of athleticism in the back. They don't have a lot of speed. They don't have a lot of agility, and because of that, they can get exploited very quickly. So even outside of the mental gaps that they seem to make, they're also just aren't very athletic. So that all needs to be addressed. But I think as an Arsenal fan, I'm not speaking as just like an observer of the game, as a fan of frustrating pieces, everyone knew about this before the season began. I mean, this was very, very clear that this was the main problem that you have, and it wasn't addressed. And so, you know, they're going to finish eighth or ninth, and that's where we kind of predicted that they'd finish at the beginning of the year. And, you know, they made their bed. Now they have to sleep in it and take a bad loss to a team that has grossly underperformed this year, judging by how they brought back everybody from last year who final in the Champions League. So it's not surprising, I'll put it that way. It's frustrating, but again, when the game was over, I was like, you know, just because they won two games and one of them happened to be against a team that does not want to play for their coach anymore. I mean, yeah, basically our biggest win of the year was a win over Wolves away. That's kind of the way it's going to look.
So I want to bring in another voice who is probably going to have a slightly different perspective on this. Los, how you doing?
Oh, when the Spurs go marching in. Oh, when the Spurs go marching in. I want to be in that number when the Spurs go marching. Oh, when the Spurs go marching in.
Yeah. I'm going to let him enjoy this.
Yeah, hey, we haven't had much to enjoy since the semifinal last May. So we're enjoying this one because, you know, this is one we definitely want to win every year. Just the whole North London Derby. It's bragging rights. And, you know, that's all it is bragging rights, but it's bragging rights. And so we own North London for now.
You just heard Stead say, you know, probably Arsenal's biggest win this year is away against Wolves. Would this be Tottenham's biggest win of the year?
Oh, well, that's – yeah, I would say it would be because they really haven't won very many big games. As a matter of fact, they've lost games where they probably shouldn't have lost. I mean, when they lost we still got to play Newcastle a second time. And we lost to them earlier this year. We shouldn't have lost that game. It's just we've been underperforming for where we should have been. Coming off the Champions League final, we should have been playing way better in the early part of the season. This is what cost Pochettino his job, which I don't know. It wasn't just the beginning of the season because the Spurs have been tailing off since they got second place about, 4 or 5 years ago, and they've been tailing off the number of points. When you go ahead and – oh, geez, hang on. Steve's coming. Woo! All right. Hey, thank you, Kobe.
Bless you.
All right. So where was that? Oh, yeah. Spurs have been decreasing the number of points they've had total since they got the second place finish years ago, and it doesn't seem like they're all firing on all cylinders. We didn't do much in the transfer period a couple times here because they were building the stadium. They didn't have money to put into getting players, and Pochettino kind of just bit the bullet with that. And I think I'll be honest with you. I think because he was willing to deal with that as it was and say, okay, fine, well, you know, you've got this big stadium coming. We're not going to put money into this transfer period or like two or three transfer periods they didn't do anything. And he bit the bullet. And they should have stuck with him at least through the season. But it just didn't seem like it was a fair shake, especially after the guy took you to the Champions League final. So that's my take on that. I'll be honest. I've heard a lot. I didn't hear the earlier part of this broadcast, but I've heard in grumblings from Arsenal fans about David Luiz and his subpar performance on defense. And I got to say that the goal that Sonny scored wasn't his fault. It was a bad pass.
No, it wasn't his fault. It was a bad pass from
his teammate.
Yeah, that was Klassen.
Yeah, Klassen.
Yeah,
he misplayed it. He turned our affectionately known as Sideshow Bob around the other way, and Sonny was too fast for him, and that's just how that happened. So that wasn't Luiz.
No, can I piggyback on that? Because I mean, Luiz has had his ups and downs this year, but I don't think he's been the main catalyst for Arsenal's defensive woes. And, you know, to put him in that position.
It sure looks like it.
Well, no. But to put him in that position, though, I mean, you're right. You saw the pass. I mean, they could have had a world-class sprinter back there, and they wouldn't have been able to do anything to stop that goal. That was just – but again, you know, it doesn't really matter what the game plan was for that goal. If you can't pass the ball 5 yards effectively, I mean – you can forget it. There's nothing you can do. I mean, you could have had a mixture of the greatest defenders of all time, and that goal still would have gone in.
Probably.
Can I interrupt? Yeah. All I would say that there is a very clear moment where Louise obviously has to turn in an opposite direction because the ball's coming in the wrong direction towards him. But there is a second period where he has the chance to slide tackle and foul outside the area, which obviously would hopefully have stopped that goal movement. But he obviously can't slide tackle to his left. Is that right? To
so
his left.
Potentially then you're looking
then
at a possible red card and Arsenal playing with 10 men for the rest of the match.
Yeah.
What's the trade-off
there?
That's
what I was going to say. With Luis's lack of speed now, he's got plenty of miles on those legs. With his lack of speed now, that he would have kicked him in the back of the calf. Probably.
You might have grazed the bottom of the cleat.
Yeah, that's about it. And, you know, especially after some of the runs that Son has put on this year. Look, everyone knows I have no love lost for Spurs, but everyone also knows that I have a lot of respect for Son Heung-min as a player. And, he was completely out of his element trying to go up against that player.
Where are Spurs Los going to go from here? Is this a one-off victory, just take it as this game? Is this something that Jose can use to get them started? Are you not 100% sure it's anything?
Well, where they're going from here is St. James's Park. That's tomorrow. That's all we've got. We got Newcastle, which we got to amend for the earlier loss this season. We got Leicester City is always tough, and they're coming off a loss and a rather ugly loss. And then we got Crystal Palace, who is always a nemesis. They're always tough to play. And we play Palace away. We're playing them at Selhurst Park. So it's the schedule looks like we got two walks in the park, but not so fast. The games we should be winning, we're not winning handily like we should. And that always bothers me. It always bothers the Spurs fans. You know, wherever we are, you know, we're always bothered by the bottom feeders because they always play us tough, we don't play up to the standard we should. We aren't winning the games we should. You know, all the teams that are below 500, if you will, we should be walking over these guys and we're not. And so that's a problem, and it needs to be remedied. But I don't have a solution for it except bring back Pochettino.
Yeah.
Well, I asked you when you got Mourinho, how you felt about that. And at the time, you were hopeful. And have your feelings towards Mourinho changed over the course of the little more than half the season that he's managed?
Okay, so when we first asked this question, I was hopeful. Now I guess you're saying I'm hopeless.
I'm just asking straight up. Has your opinion on that changed?
Well, it's kind of hard to get mad at a guy when you beat the rival. You know, you win. You won 2-1. Well, hell, maybe something's turning here. I'm still not sure why he doesn't play Tenge and Dumbele. I don't understand that. There's a personality conflict there. He needs to be out there, especially since Dele has been hurt and nursing a hamstring. The midfield is, Sissoko and Lo Celso, and there really isn't much else. You know, half it winks, but he's a little more defensive. But there really isn't much else out there. I don't know why he doesn't look at the tape and realize whenever you have Lo Celso out there, when you have Lamella out there, the two of them together, the Argentine connection, those guys know how to play with each other. And they're like a spark when they come off the bench. Well, you know, he tried starting them. Maybe you just need to, you know, put them on the bench and bring them in the second half. You know, watch that spark happen because they know they got limited time to do things, and they just do it. It's a different style of play, and it catches teams off guard. And Tanguy Ndombele plays well with those guys, and I'd like to see that, but I'm not seeing it. As far as Mourinho goes, he's going to do what he's going to do. It's boring, unattractive soccer, and it's sucking the life out of me. You guys warned me about it, and, well, you're right. Here we are.
Hey, Los, really quickly, what do you think of the possibility of them selling Ndombele?
Well, if they're going to sell him, they got to sell him for more than 65, because that's what the transfer fee was for him when they got him. So I don't know that any team's going to want to take him for more than 65, because we won the Ndombele sweepstakes by outbidding everybody, mm-hmm. and nobody wants to pay that much for him to take him off Arena's hands. But if you paid that much for, and that's like one of the highest amounts ever paid for a transfer, I mean, for Spurs, if you're going to pay that much, you got to play the guy. You can't keep him on the bench.
So, any parting shots, Los?
Go ahead, man. Hit me in the stomach, man. You earned
sure?
it.
I know. I got to keep this rated PG, right?
Yes.
Okay. All right. When I was just a little boy, my mother gave me a little toy, an Arsenal fan on a string. She told me, okay, good night, folks.
All right. Thanks a lot, Lowe.
See you later. Thanks for having me.
See you, Lowe, right. man. Good talking to you as
right.
always,
you,
brother.
Take care. You have to give him a chance to gloat.
Hey, he
earned
it.
The same thing.
He earned it. You know what? And now that he's hung out, I'm just going to throw a little shot because, you know, Arsenal fans get swept by Spurs and finish eighth, we wouldn't celebrate. So, you know.
although, so there's some good news there. I didn't. I obviously haven't bothered looking at Spurs' last three league games. So there is a very, very small outside chance that St. Totteringham's Day is around the corner.
Yeah, man. I got my special St. Totteringham's Day scotch. I haven't been able to drink in a couple of years,
I
man.
Know.
Oh.
I know.
Well,
he did bring up the fact that they have what could be an awkward run-in for them. Arsenal's run-in ain't exactly the easiest.
No.
Mm-hmm.
But
no.
But we'll see what this team's made out of. I think the last week has been very disappointing. We'll see what we can do because we've obviously got Liverpool on Wednesday and the matter of a semi-final on Saturday.
Yeah, but the Leicester draw was just bad.
Yeah.
That was really bad, and that made me nervous because I didn't want Arsenal to have the pressure of having to win the North London Derby, because as any Derby game, you got to kind of throw out where teams are. You got to throw it out. You know there's going to be something else going on that day. And so I was hoping that if they happen to get that win, then the pressure to win that game wouldn't be so strong. And the consistently inconsistent officiating that has occurred over quite some time has definitely bit Arsenal during that game. And there now. And then, of course, that I think that set them up poorly. I had a bad feeling about the Derby game after that Leicester game. And I guess my bad feeling was correct.
Well, you were the one who said, can I talk to you about the Derby game after the Leicester game?
Yeah, exactly.
Last
mm-hmm.
week.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew how your opinion was going to change based on that. And
right.
as you said, it was a draw,
mm-hmm.
1-1.
Mm-hmm. Bad draw, though.
Post
red card draws are always painful, man. Those are always painful.
Yes. It came. Leicester ended up with a man advantage after Bukari Sakho spent all of about 3 minutes on the pitch and made more contact with the Leicester player than he ever did with the ball.
Yeah, he had his Steven Gerrard moment there, you know.
And Katia.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You said Bukayo Saka. It was
Eddie Nketiah.
I'm sorry. Turning now, one of the things that we had talked about was this game on Sunday was going to play a major role in the race for Europe, and it still will. Some very, very interesting results this weekend. Leicester cruising at 1-0, loses 4-1 to Bournemouth and picks up a dumb red card. Sheffield United, who haven't been able to score all season, find a way to put 3 past Chelsea.
Mm-hmm.
Liverpool drop points at home.
Mm-hmm.
A very interesting weekend. Was there any result this week that stood out to you as being like the most just confusing one? For me, that Bournemouth Leicester game was just bananas. I still have very little explanation for that. Dominic Solanke, who couldn't score in a brothel with a fistful of hundreds up today, ended up with a brace. I'm not sure whose brace was more unexpected, his or David McGoldrick's. But, Leicester just threw it away. Was there any – what result stood out to you, Stead?
Yeah, I mean, say what you want about – I mean, West Ham went out and did what they needed to do against Norwich. But, you know, Norwich is such a defeated team, and I really feel for those players because they do have some quality on that squad. And they who played with heart a lot this season. They just had trouble getting goals and really actually sustaining any sort of momentum. But, you know, I have to agree. The Bournemouth-Leicester game was ridiculous. And, you know, the red card by Soyuncu, was one of the most Bush League things I've ever seen. I mean, the ball was clearly in the goal. And the play was over. The player was already falling. And then you're going to take a kick at his legs like that. That was really dangerous. And the fact that you protested any sort of red card, if he had half a brain, he should have put his head down and walked off the field immediately, because now his season is over with. And he actually had been a quality back for Leicester for a lot of this season. And, you know, the only positive that came out of that is that Jamie Vardy looks like he's going to secure the golden boot. Leicester's free fall since the restart has been It's been terrible, actually. It's just been terrible. I can't think of a better adjective than that, because that squad was one that we were talking about as not even really one as a threat to not be. We're talking about fighting for the fourth place in Champions League. And Leicester was solidly in third, knocking on the door to second when Manchester City was having their bumps and getting L's every now and then. And now looking at it as, even with the draw for Manchester United today, you cannot say that Leicester is secure in Champions League, and it looks like that they're going to fall out, and that's what's really going to be sad about it. And, you know, Bournemouth went from having no confidence at all to looking like they were ready to, you know, be a team that finished ninth like they did a few years ago. So that was the most surprising finish to me. Overall, having the four teams that are kind of like teetering around for those final two confirmation spots in Premier League and the final two confirmation spots for relegation that they all won this weekend. So at least that's going to heat up a bit of a relegation battle to end the season, which is, you know, I always find it enjoyable to watch, but that was disappointing. That was just a disappointing game to watch because of the way Leicester fell apart. And you're seeing how they still have Kasper Schmeichel could start on any team in the Premier League, maybe outside of maybe two or three. He's good enough to start, and he's really done well to be a loyal player for that squad. And I know he's had opportunities to go elsewhere, and he's decided to remain. So you know, it's a shame to see him have to go through that.
Sean, was there anything that stood out to you this weekend as far as a result?
Yeah, I think what stood out to me was just the craziness of some of the results, really. You've already mentioned the Bournemouth result, but again, if you'd asked me on Sunday morning who was going to get relegated after the results on Saturday and the emphatic win that West Ham had, I happened to watch the Watford game and they played well, I thought, although obviously they a couple of penalties to get their win, but I just didn't see any. I didn't see the Bournemouth or indeed the Villa result coming in any shape or form. So
yeah,
it's quite exciting. I'm looking at the league table as we now have a sort of mini league for the relegation places, and it looks like it's in two from four effectively. And indeed the Champions League places now, that becomes a lot more interesting as well. There's three games left, Chelsea, Leicester and Man U, only a point between them. Chelsea have got the worst goal difference, but Chelsea have got one big advantage. I think they play Norwich tomorrow, so you would maybe assume that they're going to get the 3 points off Norwich, but then relegated teams often bounce back with a strange result as well, don't they? So,
yep.
Sorry, I'm very sorry to see Norwich go down, but the one thing that I would suggest to Mr. Arteta is to go and have a look at some of their defenders, because they've got a couple of good young kids there. Ben Godfrey's one that I'm thinking of. So I'm sure that some of the kids that were exposed to Premier League football this year will have the chance, hopefully, to play again in the league next year. So I think it was, you know, obviously the most bizarre result was Tottenham beating Arsenal 2-1. But apart from that,
entertaining. So yeah, Chelsea do have Norwich coming up tomorrow to kick off the 36 rounds of fixtures. But they also have a FA Cup semifinal on Sunday against Manchester United. And then they travel to Liverpool on Wednesday before their last game at home to Wolves. And Wolves. And so Wolves on the last day could be a little bit tricky, because if they're still playing for anything like European positions, you know they're going to give Chelsea a game. Manchester United will travel to Crystal Palace, where they have West Ham at home, and then they travel to Leicester City. Leicester have, as Lowe said, he was talking about Tottenham, but Leicester have a tricky run of fixtures, as I bring it up right now. They host Sheffield United, fresh off of three-goal victory.
Good.
I mean, who saw that coming?
And no one wants to play Sheffield right now. Nobody wants to play them now.
Before they travel to Tottenham, and then they host Manchester City, which could be a Champions League play-in game on the last day of the season. So even with the draw, I mean, just on paper, on current form, based on strength of schedule and whatnot, you would probably say in the race it would be advantage United, because they have a slightly easier run of fixtures. But as we've seen this last couple of weeks, anything can happen.
Mm-hmm.
And even though there's some separation in between Chelsea, Leicester, and Man City, you know, Wolves is only 4 points back. Sheffield is five. You know, it's not outside the realm of the possible that, you know, if those teams start to stutter, that Arsenal could get sucked in it, although I doubt it at 50. But there's a little race for Champions League. There's a race for Europa League. There's a race for relegation. And one thing that has certainly, I guess, heated up, or if you're in England, hotted up, the race for Europe was the decision that was released today in the Manchester City case. I'm going to go with, I was right. I told y'all they'd get off. And the Court of Arbitration for Sports said that the evidence that Manchester City presented said that they did not engage in the activity that UEFA did, and that the evidence presented either did not prove UEFA's case or
outside the five-year statute of limitations. So they erased the two-year penalty and reduced the fine for failing to participate in the investigation to $10 million, which for Man City is a drop in the bucket. So, Sean, I want to get your reaction to this decision first.
Well, like you, Mike, the first thing I say is I wasn't surprised. In fact, I think we were having a chat on WhatsApp, were we not, a little while ago, and I seem to remember that the last time we had this debate on the pod, I was convinced that Man City would probably get off, and indeed they did. So I think what's most depressing from my perspective is the fact that they've been fined £10 million, and had this been Arsenal, that would have been more than our entire transfer budget for the summer, so that would have suffered for the next season. But no, there's something dramatically, the only word that I can think of, because the German newspaper that originally released the story must have felt they had a strong case, because I wouldn't like to be sued by Man City's money, that's for sure. So the story was obviously enough to get it to the Court of Arbitration. It's disappointing. Does it send out the right message? Not particularly. It looks as though it's left the door open for Man City to go out and purchase whatever they need to purchase in the future to remain as competitive as they have been over the last four or five seasons. So the only thing I would say was there was a lot of talk about some of the players, not rumours about players maybe wanting to move if they weren't allowed back in the Champions League, etc. And I suppose from that perspective, at least we will retain the talent that Man City have for the Premier League. Because I still believe that behind the scenes, I'd love to see some viewing figures over the last 8 to 10 weeks in terms of what leagues have attracted what viewing figures. And hopefully the Premier League is still up there. But I do think what's happened with Man City is very disappointing, to say the least.
Stead.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's very disappointing. And you know, we discussed the was it Der Spiegel, I believe that was the publication. We discussed it a couple of years ago, and the smoking gun that they presented was pretty compelling.
Yeah.
And you know, we did a little bit of research and just said, look, there's a lot here, and to have it be simply a £10 million or euro, whatever penalty. You're right. I mean, he probably carries that in his back pocket and throws him on the table and walks out like Richard Pryor did in Harlem Nights. So it's really not anything. And now you're looking at it going, well, essentially financial fair play is out the window. And you see Manchester City not 10 minutes after this result was published, they released that they're going to have £150 million to spend on transfers this year, and are already looking at a few players and defenders and stuff that are coming out of Germany and everything like that. And it's like, wow. Okay. So now you can see clubs with, if you have the big money owner, which it looks like Newcastle is trying to land right now, it's fair game to just pump in whatever money you want and have a sponsorship from any dummy organization you choose to set up. And there you go. So what I fear is that any sort of governing body, and you know, there was a couple of reports, I know Sky Sports reported, or at least made a statement that this could be taken up a level to some court of arbitration in Switzerland, but that doesn't really have jurisdiction over the decision. It's whether or not everything was kind of above board as far as the ruling was concerned. And they're not going to do anything else. UEFA basically said, okay, we lost. They're going to pack up their bags and go home. So that's another indication that that any sort of governing body that oversees European football is essentially non-existent. Now, there is potentially they still have to face some sort of ruling from the Premier League or from the FA in England, but there's no I mean, you saw what happened with Wigan, you know? What are they going to do, you know? So who knows what's going to happen there? Most likely nothing. So the concerning part, though, is you're just going to see a widening gap between the haves and the sort of haves and the have-nots. And you're going to see teams like Arsenal and Spurs and maybe even a team like not Chelsea, but teams that have owners that aren't willing to just throw all their money into the team. And so you're going to see a new big four, and Arsenal and Spurs are probably going to be down a bit, and it's going to be maybe they won't be able to compete in Champions League anymore. So that's the sad part. But, you know, there's lots of also owners that are coming in from Asia, from Malaysia and Singapore, who have a lot of money to throw around. Leicester's owner has already brought up the fact that he can't pump in his money into his club and why that isn't fair. And with this ruling, you can see him saying, great, I'm pumping in money into my club because I got it to do it. I think this is going to get pretty hairy, and you're going to see a lot of odd things occurring in the very, very near future.
I do believe, though, that there is still an investigation ongoing into City for another subsequent period, which actually does not fall within outside of the 5-year window. And part of me, after further reflection, says that UEFA needs to come back and do something.
Agreed.
And much like when it gets jobbed, they don't lose much. But when they do, they take it personal. UEFA is going to need to reassert its authority one way or the other over financial fair play, because at first blush, it's exactly what you and Sean, just said, that there's no ability to enforce financial fair play. In fact, in a lot of ways, there's no ability for UEFA to enforce and investigate anything. So in order for them to, I guess the best phrase that I can come up with is reassert their dominance, they're going to have to go after somebody. Who better to go after than the people who just beat you? I would caution Newcastle or PSG or even Man City to really get too comfortable, because I have a strange feeling that UEFA is going to be back around. Isaac Newton's, I think it was third law of physics, for every action there is an equal and opposite reaction.
Yes, sir.
I predict there will be
the only thing that gives me no confidence in what you've just said is, I mean, look what happened with Sepp Blatter. How is that man still allowed anywhere near the FIFA head offices? Every investigation that's gone on at the highest level in football, whether it's FIFA or UEFA, and we can go back not that long ago with UEFA with the absolutely ludicrous fines they were charging for some of the Eastern European countries for the racism. At some of the grounds, you know, like fining €10,000 or something to the Bulgarian Federation. I mean, it's just been a shambles for the last, you know, 5-10 years probably. And I don't know what the solution is, but I hear what you're saying, but I doubt very much that will happen. Much to the shame.
That's what I want to hang on to right now, so you're going to let me have it.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, with all of these situations too, you always have to say, you know, follow the money. And, you know, I know anytime there's any sort of pressure on any team for any sort of bad dealings and everything like that, if you can put pressure on the wallet, then that seems to get some level of justice in the way of changing things in any manner. But the army of lawyers that these teams can employ, and you know, you really would hope that UEFA would say, okay, look, we are, you know, you brought up Sepp Blatter, we already have egg on our face from the Sepp Blatter situation.
But
you know, Sepp Blatter is FIFA, that is very, very true. But it's still, you know, FIFA and UEFA, I really, you know, you can't equate FIFA with like CONMEBOL so much or with CONCACAF and everything, but you know, FIFA and UEFA, they're like the big two that make all the decisions. And it's not really, it's bleak. I would say, I think it is quite bleak to believe that while, yes, Mike, I agree, I really hope that they say they go back, they redo their homework a bit, and they start, you know, crossing their T's and dotting their I's a little bit more to really make sure they have something solid. And the hope would be that they could bring something to Manchester City and say, look, we can agree that you will serve this particular punishment. That way it won't be so bad for your product moving forward, and it won't be so bad for us moving forward as well. And they can come to some sort of under-the-table agreement and then present something that shows that, yes, UEFA still has some sort of governing and enforcement authority, and Manchester City can say, yes, that's true, and we're still operating above board like we've always said we have, you know, hunch, hunch, wink, wink, then at least that way both organizations can have some level of saving face. But again, I'm hanging on to something just like you are, Mike, because you don't want to see you don't want to see the game get more away from its root and from its culture than it already has. I mean, from my perspective, some of it was absolutely necessary, because without those particular dealings, we may not have the exposure of the league that we do over here in the United States. Because, as I said before, when I was, you know, talking about how I became a fan of the English game in the first place, it came from reading newspapers in the public library on the military base. And the only reason why I was on the base, because, you know, it's a very international area. So, you know, at least we have a lot of game to watch because of the money that's involved in the game. But you hope the money doesn't have so much of an effect that the culture of the game changes. Now, you know, just look at Twitter, look at Bleacher Report after this went down, how I don't know how many I saw that were talking about, you know, you're seeing them getting ready to set up for the European 20s, you know, or they're going to have the European Super League. It's coming, blah, 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 blah. It's going to be here in 2 years. That was everywhere. And I actually was surprised and hoped that I wouldn't see that, but that's what was put out there. So I do think it's going to get ugly before it gets any better.
So just as a aside, as we're doing this, I'm watching the MLS is back tournament, LAFC versus Houston. LAFC was down 3-1 at halftime. It is now the 72nd minute, and LAFC has come back to make it 3-3. So all of a sudden, this game and this tournament just got real, 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 real interesting. But that's my plug for that. I totally agree with you. You know, it's both a blessing and a curse. The money that has been pumped in by Man City has elevated the profile of the English game. By adding Man City, it has forced Tottenham, it has forced Liverpool, it has forced Manchester United, it has forced Arsenal, everybody to compete. And as a result, we are getting the viewing figures, the availability of the games, things that we didn't have previously. Mm-hmm. You know, this Thursday aside, when all the games will be streaming, I've said it on more than one occasion, I have the ability to watch more games in the United States for English soccer than Sean does.
Yep.
In England.
Yep.
That's pretty crazy.
It's still baffling.
It's the only time in history, Mike, that we will have the same number of games that you will, because they've showed all 92 games effectively since the restart. But there's already stories in the papers that it's all going to go back to normal and the contracts will be split between 3 or 4 TV companies next year. Including
this was not on the script for today, but you brought up TV contracts, Sean. Dad, did you see something, what I saw, that CBS is picking up the Champions League over here?
Yes.
And so that'll be – maybe we can go back to actually getting Champions League and Europa League games on TV, which had not been happening because they were all on Bleacher Report and TNT, which was an absolute and utter disaster. So, Sean, while we may be able to see more English games than you can see in England, you can definitely see more European games than we can see in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Right, okay.
I had an easier time watching Champions League on my phone than I did anywhere in any other possible publication. So
Only watch the Europa League on a tablet.
Yes.
Or on a streaming device. You couldn't even watch that on TV.
Hello, John.
Hello?
Yep. You're fine. Or maybe not.
Yeah, I lost you for a second, I think.
Yeah, you're good.
You're good.
Yeah.
You're good. Good. So, yes. While I've got about 5-10 minutes left, as good as this weekend was in Premier League soccer, we did have an unfortunate reoccurrence of some just stupid behavior on social media. It started on Sunday before the Crystal Palace game with Wilfried Zaha posting some messages that he got, and ended with David McGoldrick, the black striker for black Irish striker for Sheffield United, reporting on some abuse that he got on social media after their win at Chelsea. Stead, do you want to pick up the story a little bit from there?
Yeah, you know, it appears that there was a Villa fan who, when you look at his handle closely, it appeared that he also wrote some pretty negative things about Ian Wright before, and very racially motivated. And then, of course, under it said something like, I apologize, you know, I was drunk when I wrote these, and I was not in my right state of mind. That was inappropriate. And I'm just kind of putting some things together that don't really make sense, because then Zaha, Wilfried Zaha, he's an English player, but he's currently playing for Ivory Coast internationally after unable to really kind of get consistent England calls. And he had some very, you know, I mean, I hate to say it, but it's run-of-the-mill imagery of, you know, black face, white lips, using Ku Klux Klan, which I didn't know had much of a presence over in England, but
I don't believe they do.
Right, using Ku Klux Klan imagery as well as some racial epithets and terms. And, you know, it looked like it was like, okay, we're having to do this. We're going to do this again. It has been a couple of weeks before this has popped up, so I guess it was about time. And Zaha, of course, put it out there and said, this is what was here. This is what I received this morning. This is what I woke up to. And, you know, the Villa fan also said that, you know, if you better not score any goals today, or else we're going to come get you. And it was all very juvenile and idiotic. And I'm glad I could use the word juvenile, because since the authorities locally have arrested a 12-year-old boy believed to be connected to this Twitter account. And
The 12-year-old boy who's connected to the Twitter account is also saying, I'm drunk.
Yes. I
know that the drinking age in England is a little bit different than it is here in the United States, but I don't believe it's 12.
I don't think it's 12. I don't think 12-year-olds could quite see over the bar just yet. So unless he's one of those genetic freaks who's about, I don't know, 5'10 by the time he's 12, then that doesn't seem to make much sense there. So I don't know. Because I was 5'9 when I was 12, but whatever. So it just seems a little odd that a kid that young would use that type of excuse the first time around, if that, of course, is the same Twitter account as the one that was on Zaha. So, it's – Sean, go ahead and pick it up. But, yeah, it just seemed really, really, really like, come on. You still think this is something that's cute? You really think that's going to work? The sad thing is that – that clouded the win for Villa, because that was a big win for Villa. But I can honestly say, watching that game, I hope Zaha was going to put in two. And I'm not the biggest Zaha fan anyway, so, but I was hoping he'd put in at least two.
Yeah, it's just extraordinary, isn't it, that this came from a 12-year-old. And they gave to arrest the 12-year-old, but they, you know, they should arrest his dad as well. Because,
right.
This shit doesn't come out of your mouth as a child, does it? I mean, it's obviously been passed on as an influence. And, yeah, really, really disappointing. And you mentioned Ian Wright and the scenario that a few weeks ago. And, yeah, I don't know how we eradicate this from society, but that's a different debate for a different pod, as they say.
I'll be honest, I think what you're seeing is a way to eradicate it. One thing that I have loved has been all the Black Lives Matter protests before the games and how you've seen the players take the knee and stuff and things like that. And I, one of the great things that has come out of this whole movement has been just in sports, Black players in sports like soccer and sports like baseball and sports like cricket, being able to take agency and say, we're going to stand up, we're not taking this anymore. You know, and you've seen it throughout. Sean and I alluded to it earlier, and totally off the field, but West Indies, who, as you can imagine, are going to field a mostly black, an entirely black team, were playing the first test cricket match of since the restart over in England. And before the match, there was a moment of silence, and they took a knee, and it was great to see all the West Indies players who are – the team is all black and joined by the England team who has one black player who happens to come from Barbados. No, like legitimately born and raised in Barbados. Not – my family is from Barbados, but I was born in England. No, Jaffa Archer was born in Barbados. He played for the West Indies until, what, Sean, like last year?
Yeah, it's probably two years ago, 2019, I think it was, before he came over to play quite a low level of cricket in this country, actually.
Yeah. So you have that dynamic. We talked with Charlie about what the Philadelphia Union players did. And, you know, not a lot of they have African-American players, but they also have a lot of West Indian players, a lot of South American players, a lot of Caucasian players, a lot of European players. I think that the agency that you've seen has been great. And when Sean, when you bring up, like, how do we stop this in sports, I think that's one of the ways that you do it. You allow them to take the agency and say, like, look, no, we're not taking this. We're not going to sit here. We're not going to be silent anymore. We're going to let you know how we feel. And it was a doggone shame that it happened. Part of me wants to say, like, I don't feel like it is reflective of entirely reflective of English soccer fans. I will say, present company included, every British soccer fan that I've met has been pretty nice to me. But then again, I'm African American, so the ones who don't want to talk to me aren't going to talk to me.
I, what was encouraging, Mike, was the fact that the police took action on the day.
Immediately.
And that immediately. And that's the first time that I've seen sort of that reaction from the British police over these sort of stories. But perhaps the fact that the Ian Wright story has been quite recent as well. But that is encouraging to see that the authorities are taking action.
We were talking hours in between the time that this came out and the time that they said we have made an arrest, and they attributed it to a number of people coming out and saying, like, hey, we don't want to be represented that way. And I think that's going to be a large part of it. You know, Arsenal fans, Crystal Palace fans, Manchester United fans, the fans themselves are going to need to stand up and say, we don't want this to be our reputation.
Right. Right. But the problem is that not enough clubs throughout Europe have said that the fan groups not done enough to kick him. They don't police themselves. They don't. And I know that I would say that Villa fans breathed a sigh of relief when they heard it was a 12-year-old boy. That was definitely a relief because, as we all know, 12-year-old boys are stupid. And when I was 12 years old, I was stupid. And I'm sure that most men will agree that when they were 12, they made idiotic decisions that they are not proud of or that they weren't proud of probably by the time they were 15 years old. So that is one way where they went, okay, whew. But that doesn't take away or over, you know, kind of throw a blanket on how often this occurs throughout football and throughout sport. And unless the fan groups actually come out and say that this isn't tolerable. And even because I really don't believe that even if FAs from around the world dock teams points for this type of behavior, I still don't think that's enough to make fans stop. It won't be until they don't receive approval from their peer group that will this stop. Because once they get pushed out of that environment and they are truly made to feel that that is unacceptable and we want you to remain part of this group, but that is unacceptable, will anything actually really change? They have to police themselves better. And until they do, as long as you have like Inter Milan, who basically told Romelu Lukaku that they're just doing it because they want to win and it's okay and that's just part of the culture, as long as that mentality is still prevalent amongst fans of European teams, we're just counting the days until this happens again.
I agree.
Well, yeah. So, gentlemen, we are really, 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 really up against it. I want to start by giving a shout out to our sponsor, as always, which I, in my exuberance, have not done at all. But a big shout out to Flanagan's Hawk and Fiddle, 4844 Cordell Avenue, Bethesda, Maryland. Maryland's premier venue, once again, for live sports and entertainment. As long as you do it on after 3 o'clock and you do it social distance-wise. I want to thank producer Paul for keeping all the trains running on time. Carlos for coming in and gloating, although I don't need to thank him. I'm pretty sure he was willing to do that no matter what. A big shout out to Charlie Flo for joining us from Philadelphia. As we get out of here, guys, you got about 30 seconds. Parting shots. London, Sean.
Parting shots. Very much looking forward to the FA Cup semi-final this coming weekend. Do I hold out much hope? I don't, but it's the FA Cup, and we are the record FA Cup holders. So come on the Arsenal this time.
That's right.
All right, Mr. Stead.
If you watch one Premier League game during the week on Thursday, Leicester-Sheffield, that is a very, very big game. You have the team that was stumbling out of the restart who's now seemed to refound their form and are climbing back up the table versus a team that is an utter free fall but with the leading goal scorer in the Premier League. Exciting game. That's the one I'm going to watch.
We are supposed to have a watch party Zoom chat on Thursday. I hope you gentlemen will join me, because I don't want to be stuck in this by myself again. That is really, 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 really boring. I like myself, but I can't talk to myself for that long. Man, it's getting really, really interesting in the Premier League. Pay attention to those mini races. This is what we always want at the end of the season. We thought it would be not interesting with Liverpool winning the league at a canter, but you've got a race to get back into the Champions League, a race for the Europa League, and a race against relegation. And as we always say about the 20 teams in the Premier League, at the end of the season, there are very, very few dead rubbers, and that's what I like about the Premier League. Mm-hmm. So keep watching. The MLS back tournament is going to throw up. Just after I said there hadn't been a lot of goals scored, I'm going to get a game with 6 goals, as I'm pretty sure that this LAFC Houston game is going to end in a 3-3 draw, but I've been wrong before. For London, Sean, Armstead, producer Paul, Charlie Flo, and Los, this is Mike. This has been the Two Guys Soccer Show. We did all right this week. We'll try and do better next week.
Take care.